ABC Listen. Podcasts, radio, news, music, and more.
It is a truth universally acknowledged that on one's 250th birthday, there should be a celebration. I'm Claire Nichols, and on The Book Show, we're raising our teacups to Jane Austen.
Why Austen? What is it about her?
Authors Colm Tobin, Karen Joy Fowler, and more will explore why, in 2025, the Austen effect is bigger than ever.
That's quite incredible.
Search for The Book Show and look for Dear Jane wherever you get your podcasts, or hear it now on the ABC Listen app.
It's not just on social media. The whole world, it seems, is in a state of collective denial about ageing. From 20-somethings getting Botox to billionaires receiving blood infusions and beyond. If you're less concerned about a few wrinkles, though, what about your brain? What's really going on in our brains as we age, and what can we do about it? Hey, welcome to Big Ideas, bringing you big thinkers at the best live events. I'm Natasha Mitchell. We've got three brains on the brain today. From a Sydney Ideas event at the University of Sydney's Brain and Mind Centre on Gadigal Country, neuroscientist Dr. Eleanor Drummond's research is uncovering the earliest biological changes in Alzheimer's disease, work that really could lead to new drugs and early detection tools. I'm up for that. Olivier Piguet is a Professor of Clinical Neuropsychology, specialising in frontotemporal dementia. His interventions are helping people and their families live more independently and with dignity. Gilbert Nags is a sociologist at the University of Sydney who brings a critical lens to the ethics of dementia prevention. And the host is award-winning journalist and presenter Elfie Scott.
To kick things off, I have a question for Olivier and Gilbert. So, Olivier, maybe we'll start with you. Do you think our understanding of aging has changed at all in recent years? And that includes the kind of priorities that we focus on.
Yes, it has.
Oh, good. Okay. Yeah.
Look, not that long ago, aging was not such a big issue. The primary aim in life was to reproduce, to have children, and once you did your job, that was it, essentially. And life expectancy was about 40 years in prehistoric times. And with the advances in medical research, environment, lifestyle, and so on, our life expectancy has changed so much. So even within the past 40 years, our life expectancy has moved from about 70 years to 85 years. So it means that there are a lot of more people in this age bracket now than there used to be. And so we are more aware of being old or being older and what it means to be older. Yeah, things change. Our bodies change, our mind change, our brain changes. And so we need to adapt to that, try to understand it, and try to mitigate some of the risks of getting old, like trying not to fall, like trying to delay some disorders that are associated with aging.
Gilbert, would you like to add anything to that?
Yeah, so I think even just on a shorter scale in the last maybe 60 and 70 years, what I found in my research is that aging is a lot more about choices and thinking about the future and also managing risks than it used to be. And there are a few different reasons for that, it seems like. I think one is, I guess science has become, or biomedical science, I should say, has come a long way. So now there's a lot more to think about when we think about aging. And also there's been a bit of a paradigm shift, it seems like, where instead of being interested in the inner causes of aging and, you know, how aging occurs as a sort of these through biological mechanisms, just in the last 30 years, there's sort of been this shift towards, okay, how does aging actually, how is it influenced from things outside of the body, and what can we do to actually act on aging? So yeah, there's just sort of been this shift in the science from looking inside the body to looking, I guess, outside of the body and what we can do through behaviours, and also how society, I guess, ages at different rates. And that's, on the one hand, led to a lot more I guess, opportunities to age well, but also a lot more anxieties, I think, around managing aging and this pressure to constantly, I guess, be on guard on aging and make the correct decision. So there's, yeah, sort of, I guess, pros and cons with that, but definitely different from what was about 60, 70 years ago, where aging was just something that happened.
Eleanor, I wanted to start off with what I imagine is a really simple, easy to answer question, which is what actually happens in the brain during the aging process?
So simple.
So simple, so, yeah. What 2 minutes.
Now, how long do I have? I guess from a basic scientist perspective, when you look in a brain of someone who is older versus younger, the same kind of things that we expect to happen to our body also happen to our brain. It becomes slower. There is atrophy over time. Interestingly, in specific regions, so you might start to know, notice some particular elements of your daily life becoming a little bit more tricky than others, and that's because those parts of your brain are actually shrinking over time. What's interesting, though, is that with aging, it's quite different from those diseases that we associate with aging, like dementia. And with those ones, the neurons are actually dying in the brain, but when you're aging, they're not really dying, there's just less connections. And as a result, the brain itself gets a bit smaller. And so when we're talking about diseases of aging, like Alzheimer's disease is the main one, other ones that we study a lot is frontotemporal dementia as well. When you look inside the brains of those people, you start to see these really characteristic features that are present, which are the neuropathological hallmarks. And this happens because your garbage, your waste disposal systems in your brain start to break down. And you start to accumulate these proteins in your brain that clump up. And as a result, it gets in the way of your brain being able to function the way that it wants to. And in addition to that, we see inflammation, we see the brain's energy processes start to get disrupted, and as a result, the brain itself starts to break down. So there's a clear distinction between aging and dementia, but age is obviously associated, is one of the key risk factors for these diseases as well. But in dementia, there is a far more complex process that is happening.
Yeah, wow. And am I correct in thinking that you wrote a sort of atlas of all of the proteins? Changes that happen in dementia?
I did, yes. Yeah. I don't know if this is of interest to the audience, but one of the key things of my research was actually trying to create a bit of a roadmap for all the different protein changes that happens in Alzheimer's disease, because I figured that if we could see everything holistically of all those bad protein changes that are happening at once, this might be able to help us understand which things might be the causative factors and which things potentially could be new drug targets. And so what's really nice is in the lab at the moment, we're getting to go through and start to study all of these individual proteins that I think might be causative of disease and see if we genuinely can make a difference and understand what they're doing in these diseases.
I love how you say, that's probably not interesting. That's probably the most interesting thing. Eleanor, can I also ask, are there any sort of persistent mysteries of how the progression of dementia in the brain? Are there big holes in the research?
Another really easy question to answer
so
in 2 minutes.
So just chill. Yeah, yeah.
There are so many mysteries. This is why I'm being like this, because there is unfortunately still so much that we have yet to discover. Some key things that we're really interested in, obviously from my last answer, is what causes neurodegenerative disease? What causes Alzheimer's disease? We don't know. And we also want to know, why do some people progress much faster than other people when they do get these diseases? We don't know the underlying cause, because you can imagine if there is a person who may have a lot of characteristic Alzheimer's pathology in their brain, but they progress slower, there's something inherent in that person that is protecting them against the disease. And as scientists, we really want to find out what is that and can we use that as a potential drug target as well. Those are just two examples. I could go on all night, but I'm sure the other two would have other ideas about giant mysteries in their field too.
I'm sure somebody will be coming up to you after this, or many people probably. Olivier, can I ask, has the diagnosis of dementia changed at all in recent years? And are there limitations around it at all?
Yes, it has. I think there's a greater awareness of dementia in general. There's still misconception about dementia, what is dementia? And often you hear conversations such as, I'm lucky, I don't have dementia, I have Alzheimer's disease, or vice versa. So there's some confusion around labels, what it means and what it represents. Dementia is not one single disease. There are multiple causes for dementias. There are probably over 100 different types of dementia. Alzheimer's disease is the most common one, and which probably accounts for about 60% of all cases of dementia. So there's a natural focus on trying to understand what Alzheimer's disease is. But certainly there's the research that I do is looking at other types of dementia, and particularly frontotemporal dementia, and trying to understand the different phenomenology, clinical presentations of people with a pathological process that is different to that we see in Alzheimer's disease. So in frontotemporal dementia, the pathology is in brain regions that are different to what is found in Alzheimer's disease. And so it leads to different features, clinical symptoms, and signs that we see as the disease progresses. The other thing is also that these brain disorders, they're progressive. So it starts in a particular region, so that will be associated with some changes, say, in memory or language or thinking abilities. And then because the disease progresses across different brain regions, then different symptoms will emerge. So it's not uncommon to see people who start with language problems then starting showing some behavioral changes, having difficulty moving around, finding their way around, coordination of movements or thinking abilities. The other aspect that I think is important to remember is, as researchers and clinicians, we like neat boxes. So we try to assign a diagnosis to a person, which is in reality is a combination of many different features. And so it's hardly ever black and white, and it's more often shades of gray. So you have a little bit of this, a little bit of that. But depending on who you see, and there have been experiments done with that where you show the same presentations to different clinicians and these people will arrive at a different diagnosis just because of their interest or because of what they focus on, if they're more interested in language or in movement. So there's a level of complexity that is quite enormous.
Mm, I mean, I'm going to ask you another question that has, I'm sure, an enormous level of complexity, which is a question that I'm sure many of us are looking to ask tonight, and that is, what are the biggest lifestyle and environmental factors that determine healthy aging of the brain?
Well, there's a good paper that has been commissioned by the Lancet Journal, and so they've done three round tables on trying to identify the what they call modifiable risk factor. And they did one in 2019, 23, and the latest one was released earlier this year. And they've identified 14 lifestyle risk factors, so modifiable risk factors, so that we can potentially modulate our risk of developing a brain neurodegenerative disorder. Some of these things are quite obvious. It's about eating well, eating healthy foods, sleeping well, doing some exercise, not drinking too much. I don't like this one, but you know what I mean. You know. So a couple of drinks is fine, but you don't want to go over the top. There's also education, your social engagement, social activities, being engaged socially and intellectually will make a difference. The limitation of these papers is that it gives you some information at a population-based level. So it tells you something. If we aggregate data from many different studies, this is what we find. However, it never tells you exactly what is your risk for Mr. X or Mrs. Y, because it depends on your life, your life history, where you grew up, what your life events were, and Gilbert can certainly talk more about this, and also your genetic makeup. So it's not just environmental risk factors, it's also how these risk factors will talk to what you were born with, your genetic makeup, and which will modulate how these genes are expressed and how it will then modulate your risk of developing these brain disorders.
What about mobile phone games? The Sudokus in the audience.
Oh, no, they're fantastic. If you do them, you'll get better at them. No doubt. On a more serious note, whether it translates to other cognitive abilities, there's no clear evidence for that. So if you enjoy doing these games, by all means, do them. And I do some of them. But there's no clear evidence that by doing that, it will rewire your brain in a way that will help you fight against dementia. Do them if they're free. You don't need to pay for them because you can get into very expensive habits.
I mean, moving on from those sort of environmental and lifestyle factors, Gilbert, you obviously have extensive research in this area. Can we talk a little bit about sort of social and economic inequality when we talk about those lifestyle factors? Because that is something that you focus on, right?
Yeah. I think just the whole idea of being able to, you know, age healthier and age better and avoid certain risks in later life through lifestyle factors, it's really appealing. And obviously, I think it's a good thing to do, to think about stuff like that. But it gets a bit more complicated when you look, or you start, I guess, asking what is a lifestyle factor and how much control over, I guess, our health choices do we really have when you look at society as this sort of big monster of many different people with different possibilities for making choices and different histories. And something simple like, you know, we should eat better to avoid a risk of dementia. You should eat a Mediterranean diet. There's really well-documented correlations between poverty and obesity. So if you can't afford to eat well, and then someone says, you know, just eat a Mediterranean diet and you'll be fine, it's kind of it's misleading, but it's also maybe not going to be as effective than if you looked at a bigger picture and thought, okay, what kind of really tricky, difficult social action or political action would need to happen for us all to sort of have a better, you know, chance at living a happy, healthy later life. And I think those questions, they're less the idea of lifestyle, it's just very appealing. And I think we all do worry about that stuff. But when you start to think, okay, what kind of reforms and how long would this take and how much would it cost to make sure we could all have a better diet realistically, it's just a lot more complicated and it's a harder job to do. The main issue is it's sort of misleading to think about risks as up to us to sort of manage as individuals. But when we look at risks as sort of collectively distributed across an unequal society, it's probably a bit more effective and the outcomes that we might achieve might be a bit more tangible in that way, I think.
Gilbert Nags is doing their PhD in sociology at the University of Sydney on the ethics of dementia prevention. And they're joined by neuroscientists Associate Professor Eleanor Drummond and Professor Olivier Piguet from the University's Brain and Mind Centre. And hosting this Sydney Ideas event is journalist Elfie Scott on ABC Radio National's Big Ideas with me, Natasha Mitchell. And I reckon whether you're 25 or 75, this is a discussion for you, because understanding how our brains age isn't just about science, it's also about how we want to live together, how we care for each other, how we reshape the future of ageing. And this is where Elfie Scott is heading next, exploring with Gilbert Nags the importance of family and social connections.
You have also conducted research on healthy ageing in rural and remote communities as opposed to urban communities, right?
Do you
mind telling us about that?
Yeah. So just getting to the end of a blown out PhD that's been going on for too long. Hopefully to the end. Yeah, so I've been looking at these ideas of healthy aging and aging as something that we can manage ourselves, and how these ideas have come about in the last 60, 70 years where, you know, I think a lot of people back sort of 1950s and 60s, aging was just something that more happened. And that's a bit of a generalization, but aging was just seen as something that, you know, death and taxes and maybe aging would be added to that. Whereas now we're much more concerned about what can I do, what can we do to make our aging a more, you know, a better experience. And in rural areas, there's certain specific difficulties that I think people face where there's, I guess, three factors where rural areas are aging faster than urban areas. And a lot of that has to do with changing economies in rural spaces. So a lot of traditional industries have sort of being corporatized or have just sort of disappeared. So younger people are moving to cities. So there's less, I guess, family connection there. There's also, I think it's everyone will know, there's health services and even community care services often struggle to get out to remote communities. And the people I spoke to had this idea of healthy aging and aging well as a lot to do with being independent and being able to age in the place that they maybe live for 40, 50 years. But when there's no services, I guess, to support healthy aging, because healthy aging isn't just about being independent, it's actually about getting the care that you need as you get older and your body changes. People were left in this, I guess, rock and a hard place where they didn't want to become a burden on their loved ones who often live quite far away. There was also no services to support their aging in place. The idea of moving to a city to be closer to family or health services wasn't very attractive just because it's, you know, you want to grow old in a place that you've called home. So a lot of people were just sort of, there was not really anywhere to move in that space, and ended up just thinking, okay, I'm just going to manage as best I can until something quite significant happens and I have to go into an aged care facility. Rural Australia had, I think, unique issues across the board, but I think a lot of it has to do with this aspiration to remain independent, but also not really having the infrastructure to support that desire that I think we all have, yeah.
You mentioned families back there. What is it specifically about those sort of family connections that facilitates healthy aging?
The idea that I think healthy aging is being independent indefinitely, it's not really realistic. So I think it's just a matter of care and support. So we're all, as we get older, we're going to need more of that. It's kind of inevitable. And then, but there's also, again, it's just most people I talk to are really anxious, and it was sort of a moral concern. I don't want to be a burden on my children. I'd rather have formal care, but that's also not available. So it was sort of this moral issue for a lot of people. But I think the family for healthy aging, yeah, care and support and also companionship. I mean, social isolation, loneliness are never good for anyone's health in any way. But yeah, just in rural areas, it's I think, more pronounced, that struggle to manage certain aspirations and also family relations.
Olivia, can you talk about the importance of, you know, highlighting those relationships?
Part of the research that we do is to understand the changes or how having something like your loved one with dementia, how it changes your relationship with that person, how it changes your role from being a partner to being a carer, and what are the variables, characteristics, features that will affect carers more than others. And again, it's very variable. You have people who are born carers and other people who are not, and that, which is fine. I think we are all different. So the way we adjust to a situation like this one, when suddenly your wife or husband is changing and developing these difficulties, and you realize that you need to be more present and involved in their day-to-day care, sometimes it's just reorienting the person, organizing their day. But as the disease progresses, it means being more hands-on, helping them being dressed, and sometimes even basic activities of daily living, like helping them go to the toilet and washing them and so on. So there are some really confronting challenges in being a carer in these situations. And we know that if we can help carers understand the process of what is happening, these changes, it makes the relationship better. We improve the quality of life, or we reduce the burden of care in carers. We improve the psychological well-being of the carer. We also improve the quality of life of the person with dementia. We improve the relationship. It means also that these families can stay together longer, because the one of the primary drivers of people moving to nursing home and supported accommodation in the event of dementia is carer burden. Carers, at some point, they go, that's it, I can't do it anymore. I would love to be able to look after you, but this is too much for me. And then you have to rely on external services. So part of the work that we do is helping carers and families to manage these situations, these transitions. And again, very individual journeys for everyone. I remember seeing a talk of a clinician who was saying, when you've seen a person with dementia, well, you've seen one person with dementia, so everyone is different. And we need to also understand what it is that is different, what is particular to your situations, and then help you manage that the best you can.
I did want to ask, I mean, I'm sure that this is relevant for people in the audience tonight, and are there any resources that you would point carers towards who are in this situation?
Oh yeah, there are associations that are supported by federal government, independent. There are places like Dementia Australia, Dementia Support Australia, there's Hammond Care. There are a number of associations. And if you start looking up websites, carer support associations, there's quite a number of things available.
I'm aware I'm asking you a lot of questions, Olivia, and we'll move on to the other panelists in a moment. But I did want to ask, as a clinician, are there any sort of big misconceptions that you see frequently when it comes to dementia diagnosis?
Yeah, probably the biggest one is just because you have a diagnosis of dementia doesn't mean that you're dumb or you're no longer a person. There's so much that can be done at all level of severity, and what you see is the social network around the person who's just been diagnosed just disappearing because people don't know how to relate to that. They don't know how to interact. Do you talk about it or do you not? Do I need to change my behavior or what do I do? And often people don't know. And again, there's still a person there. There are things happening to this person because of something happening in their brain. It doesn't mean that they've changed. They're still a unique individual here and a unique person who needs companionship, who needs interactions, who needs love, who needs hug. And yeah, so I think it's important to remember that.
Absolutely. I mean, speaking of misconceptions, there is so much pseudoscience in this space as an area which I think a lot of people hold a lot of natural fear towards aging just is a breeding ground for pseudoscience. So what are the things that you come across personally in your own work? Eleanor, if you want to jump in.
One of the issues with pseudoscience is a lot of it comes from actual, real lab science. And I think the issue that we all face is that the pseudoscience happens because everyone wants it to work so well. And we want to accelerate it towards being actually helpful. We want to translate it into all of your lives, into helping you age well or preventing you from getting dementia. A key example, which just boggles my mind, is this idea that maybe if you inject yourself with blood from young people, this will help your brains, which sounds crazy. And I know that I've spoken to some people who then say, oh yes, this sounds like an excellent doable thing. And the problem is that it's not, it sounds crazy, but it's not actually that crazy. There is lab science there backing it up, where they have done lab experiments showing that if you give a old mouse blood from a young mouse, the old mouse actually gets better. And that is real. The problem is that humans are not mice. And so if there is one takeaway in terms of pseudoscience here, it is please make health decisions based on things that have actual scientific evidence and has a clinical trial for humans. We do the mouse experiments for a reason, but you know the human experiments are critical because for the blood example, we don't know how many times a person needs a blood injection from a young person. We don't know what's in the blood that is making their brains react in a great way to kind of rejuvenate a little bit. And these are the questions that basic scientists are trying to answer in humans so that we can eventually translate it. Another key area that Olivier and I were talking about upstairs was supplements, because there are so many supplements targeted to people, particularly for aging. Again, the key issue is that there is some lab science that backs it up, and the companies, because they know they can make money, then spruik that basic lab science and say, yes, you should take this supplement because it is going to rejuvenate you. And that's not entirely untrue, except for the fact that it was done in a mouse and not in a human. So please, base your human decisions on human studies.
Seems like a very baseline.
I know. Sort of
what are the supplements that people take? Do you know?
Olivia, you would say this might be a more clinical question.
Well, are there any ones that... I mean, people might be taking them in the audience.
I don't want to throw any particular ones out there.
There are so many, but, you know, just looking at vitamins, you go to the health shop and there are rows of multivitamins, vitamin A, B, C, you name it, it's there. And as I was saying, you have pharma companies or non-pharma companies that are pushing this message, and also based on our fear and anxiety and trying to explore different ways to potentially slow down the aging process or the effect of dementia. So I understand why people would want to do that. But again, the message is just do your homework and don't waste your money on things that at the end of the day are not worth it.
Gilbert, do you have any sort of pseudoscience that you'd like to throw in the ring here?
None of the people I spoke to in rural New South Wales had any crazy pseudoscientific treatments for aging. But I think just reading some of the literature more broadly, yeah, as Olivia was saying, I think the main issue is that while aging has changed so much and there's a lot we can do and there's a lot of interesting science coming out around aging still is, it's the same as it's always been. We can't actually ever fully stop aging. And yeah, just the idea of markets playing on our hopes and anxieties around that, it's kind of, yeah, it boils your blood a bit. And yeah, I'm often, you know, on the internet marketed something, and yeah, I can definitely, I feel myself wanting to go through with that and be like, oh, maybe this will, you know, I'll get my hair back maybe. Or and then a few seconds later, you're like, damn, they're really playing into my body image and my anxieties around aging. And also I think the other issue is it does frame aging as maybe something that we should look to biomedicine to solve, and kind of prevents us from thinking about, you know, aging is something that we're probably always going to have and always going to live with. And how can we, I guess, instead of having a relationship between ourselves and our choices and markets, maybe how could we make a society that's more accepting of those realities?
I mean, Eleanor, you touched on it earlier, but what do you think the real risks are of buying into the pseudoscience, maybe even just beyond like wasting a bit of money, because everybody wastes a bit of money. Yeah. What are the real risks of it?
The real risks are, I guess it's, well, there's financial ones for sure, because you have to, like, the companies are marketing this to you because they're going to make money. But the key risk, I think, is people's hopes. And this is what we as scientists try not to do. We really try not to get people's hopes up to a point probably where we err on the side of caution, where if you ask me, do you know anything that might be good in the Alzheimer's field? I'm like, oh, I don't know if I want to tell you this in case I get your hopes up. And in the pseudoscience world, it's the total opposite. Everyone's hopes are up, thinking that they're going to take this and it's going to cure a disease or make them age slower. And it's just not real. And that, yeah, I'm with Gilbert, it makes my blood boil a little bit, because as scientists, we do this research to try and help people, not for a company to make lots of money on something that's not proven.
Yeah, 100%. Eleanor, where are we going from here in terms of drug treatments? I know we were just talking about not getting your hopes up, but what are the novel drug treatments that are emerging at the moment?
From an Alzheimer's perspective, it's actually been quite an exciting time over the last year, because for 20 years, we had no new drugs that any doctors could offer anyone. And I'm sure you've seen in the media, there are these cures for Alzheimer's disease. They're called the amyloid immunotherapies. And just today, another one was, so there's one that has been approved by the TGA in Australia, and today a second one was approved. So it'll probably be in the media tomorrow. And while this is really exciting, I think a key thing to think about is to talk to your doctor if you're interested in these, because there are some significant limitations that potentially the media don't always touch on, but as scientists and clinicians, we're very aware of. And this is where these drugs target a particular protein that accumulates in your brain, which is called beta amyloid. And what these drugs do is bind to it and then enhance its removal from the brain, which in theory is a great thing. And indeed, these drugs do this, which is why they've been approved. The main problem is that from a clinical standpoint, they don't cure the disease. They possibly offer you maybe 6 months-ish, maybe a year, slowing of the disease symptoms, which is amazing. And if you're faced with Alzheimer's disease, you may want to have that. But then there are other considerations too, and there's quite significant side effects associated with brain swelling and bleeding. And then there is also the cost. These are not covered by the PBS, and it is... it's very expensive. I think it's $46,000 a year, but I'd have to double check that.
Wow.
Oh, and Olivier was also telling me that because they're infusions, every month you have to go to a place where you get an infusion of this drug. Now, scientists are working really hard at the moment to try and make these drugs better. So there is a whole field of research focused in on these amyloid immunotherapies to try and make them work better, which is amazing. But what I want to point out as well is that there is a whole field of drug discovery scientists like myself, who are really focused in on diversifying this potential drug discovery pathway. And this is some of the research that we're doing here at the University of Sydney, where we are trying to uncover these new drug targets. This is where I'm using my roadmap of the brain. Because beta amyloid is just one thing that happens. It is really important, but what if there is something else that is easier to target and has less side effects, and we potentially can slow the disease or halt it earlier as well? And so this is, I think it's an exciting time for drug discovery. I know it's frustrating for people who want answers now, and drug discovery is inherently slow, but I'd bring it back to my point before where it needs to be slow for a reason so we can have the confidence in telling you that you are getting the drugs that are actually going to clinically help you in your disease.
Yeah, wow. I mean, talk about inequitable healthcare as well with the $46,000 fee. That's wild. Yeah. Eleanor, are there any gaps in the research that you think need to be addressed right now?
So we touched on it earlier. There are some of these mysteries that we see, such as why do people progress slower in disease versus others. But I think the key thing that we need to focus in on now is thinking, number one, about the cause of disease. Because if I can impart another thing that I obviously am very passionate about many things, it is that for us to find a cure for these diseases, we need to understand the cause. It's really hard for us to develop a drug if we don't know what's causing the disease. So I'm very passionate about the need for basic science and fundamental understanding of these diseases, because I think this will translate hopefully in the future to therapies. But also there is this push in the field of recognizing the fact that a lot of our research is done in a very small population of people. Usually it's Caucasians, and it is usually highly educated people. And so this makes it really tricky from an equitable perspective when thinking about, what if we're doing all this drug discovery research and it only works for a small population of people? And so diversifying our pools of people who are involved in these trials, I think, is critical. For a long time, we ignored women because they were too hard to study, apparently. And then the FDA had to come out in America and say everyone should include women in their experiments and female mice in their experiments. And that seems crazy, right? But we need to consider these things and advocate for them so that we're not just developing treatments for a particular cluster of people.
Yeah, absolutely. Olivia and Gilbert, maybe we can start with you, Olivia, but what are the next steps in your research? Where is it taking you?
It's similar to Eleanor's, but focusing on non-Alzheimer's dementias. As Eleanor is saying, there are different processes. It's not just about the amyloid in the brain. In the frontotemporal dementias, there are a whole range of other proteins that are involved. And the field is way behind that of Alzheimer's disease. So because of the variability in the pathological processes in the frontotemporal dementias, there's so much more that needs to be done in trying to understand these basic mechanisms. Where does the disease start? Why does it start? In frontotemporal dementia, there's a slightly larger proportion of people who have specific mutations on some genes that will trigger the disease. But still, the majority of people will develop frontotemporal dementia, but we have no idea why. So we need to understand that. And from a clinician viewpoint, there's another aspect that is very important, and I'm always at loss to try to answer these questions. When people come to see us in the clinic, they want to know three things, essentially. One is, what is happening to me? So there's the what. There's the what next. So what is going to happen to me in 6 months, in a year's time, in 5 years' time? And then, is there a treatment for it? The what, I think, is we've improved so much, even compared to 5 years ago, in identifying people who are showing the early signs of dementia and frontotemporal dementia in particular. And there's less confusion between, say, psychiatric disorders and dementia. The one where I cannot answer is, what next? What is happening to me? What will happen to me in 6 months? I dance around, I say, well, on average, we know that, etc. There's about 5 years or 7 years life expectancy from the time of diagnosis. But in our clinic, we see people who have died within 18 months and others who are still around 7, 8, 9, 10 years later. Why? I've got no idea. So we need to try to unpack that, to understand what is making you more susceptible, more at risk to go down a certain route or another one. And then there's the treatments and disease-modifying treatments. And again, in frontotemporal dementia, we are way behind Alzheimer's disease, so there's no drug available on the market. There are a few clinical trials underway. So there's progress, but there's still a long way to go. And so our focus at the treatment side is, something I alluded to, is helping families, carers, try to understand how to manage some of these changes, some of these behaviors, behavioral difficulties, or some of the language difficulties, and try to do the best with what we have and making life as meaningful and as positive as possible despite all these difficulties.
Gilbert?
So just in my studies, I've been thinking a lot about what are some of the limitations or maybe some of even the harms or negative aspects of a very, I guess, individualized relationship that we have towards aging, where we, I guess, feel aging as something that we need to work against, and how that sort of relates to, I guess, a lot of underlying entrenched fears of aging and a lot of ageism. And that's been really interesting. But I think towards the end, I'm thinking, okay, well, what would a society that could better accept, I guess, the realities of human aging, what would that look like? So I guess thinking more practically about those next, so this is maybe some of the issues. Okay, what do we do about it if aging isn't going away? And, well, I guess biomedicine is amazing, and it's a very important aspect of that question. How can we, I guess, accept our aging more as a society is the next question. And so my supervisors at Sydney Centre for Health Societies, they sort of do tackle, like, okay, how can our society adjust to, I guess, accommodate ageing in a better way? And then also, I've been doing a bit of collaborating with some researchers at Western Sydney as well, from the Marx Institute, and they're actually looking at different cultural approaches to ageing in Western Sydney and how maybe messaging around dementia prevention can also incorporate just the different approaches to ageing, understandings of ageing, which maybe we wouldn't want to just erase with a sort of healthy, brain health model.
What's going on in our brains as we age, and can science help us? And our brains thrive as we age. From the University of Sydney's Brain and Mind Centre, today's live event on ABC Radio National's Big Ideas, here with me, Natasha Mitchell, features neuroscientists Professor Olivier Piguet and Associate Professor Eleanor Drummond, and sociologist Gilbert Nags. They're with journalist Elfie Scott. And Elfie is now turning to the many questions from the audience.
I'm going to jump into the Slido now. And I can see there's a very clear sort of winner as far as the votes have gone. And maybe this is one for Eleanor and Olivier, but are people living with ADHD more at risk of developing dementia, or are people who exist in a state of chronic overwhelm or stress more at risk?
Well, yes, because, stress is bad, not just for the brain. We know that stress affects your cardiovascular system. It changes the way you respond to how your body respond to triggers in the environment. And that also leads to inflammatory responses, which we know are not good for brain health and body health and different organs, not just the brain. So yes, stress is something that will certainly increase potentially your risk of dementia. Again, there's not a single factor that will push you over the threshold. With regard to ADHD, that's a very good question, and I don't know the answer to that. I would need to look into it.
I don't think I've seen any. I haven't come across the science linking the two of them. Yeah. So unless there's a, like, it could be out there and we don't know, but it right now isn't out there so much in terms of the forefront of what we know.
Oh, this is an interesting one. How does weightlifting help anti-aging? Weightlifting?
Well, this comes into the exercise side of things. And there was studies looking at cardio exercise versus strength-based exercise. And my understanding is that strength-based exercise is great, so hence weightlifting. Not like super crazy weightlifting, like more regular weightlifting. Because it also helps with falls. If you have a stronger body, the number one thing that you want to, like, my understanding, it's very vague, is that you want to prevent falls, correct? And this is where the weightlifting would come into it.
Yep. It increases your muscle mass, it increases your bone density, and so it makes you also more able to move around more freely and less risk of falling.
But I think any exercise is great. Any exercise that someone can do is really recommended as well.
But not like extreme weightlifting. Please don't try
that. If someone can do it.
Maybe this is one for Gilbert. In cultures where it's more common for different generations of a family to live together, is there any evidence that this supports better or slower aging?
I couldn't comment on, I guess, the kind of hard health data on that. But definitely, so a lot of anthropology research does strongly suggest that, so some research, I think it's been done in India, so intergenerational households, as people get older, I guess the stress of aging and the things that I talked about with the participants in my research, the idea of being a burden, the just anxiety around aging was a lot lower. It was seen as much more of an inevitable and natural part of life. So the kinds of stressful questions people are asking and pondering over and that which are really difficult and often unanswerable were not there. So in that sense, I think different cultural approaches to aging, and especially if your status goes up as you get older, as opposed to the opposite, I think is definitely going to contribute to a much happier later life potentially. So maybe that sort of answers the question.
Yeah. Are there any other answers on the panel about intergenerational households?
It's true that our society, families are getting smaller. We live in smaller apartments, and so there's less social cohesion in that sense. And where interactions across generations are not as strong as they used to be, and people travel much more. So, for example, I'm, as you can hear, I'm not from here. My family's from the other side of the world. So there's all these things that change as the society evolves, and we're moving into slightly more fragmented societies, so which I think are also adding to these difficulties and this stress in looking after an aging parent who, I don't know, might be living on the other side of Sydney or different state.
Yeah, I was thinking about this actually today with the housing crisis in Sydney, how young and middle-aged people are being forced out of cities, and there was that headline, I don't know if anybody remembers this, from a couple of months ago where they said Sydney's going to be the city without grandchildren, and then I thought, oh, well, but it's also going to be the city without carers, right? Can learning another language prevent dementia?
It's related to brain plasticity. There's suggestion that people are bilinguals or multilinguals. When you look at the amount of pathology in their brain, will have a higher density of changes for the same level of symptoms that they have, if that makes sense. So your brain is able to sustain more injury before it says, that's it, I'm out of here, I can't perform anymore, and you will see changes. So it looks like, well, I guess there have been research done on languages, but it's also, again, about intellectual engagement and creating these new connections between your nerve cells, between your neurons. Certainly in terms of language, there's a critical period. So if you learn a language very early in life, it also represented differently in the brain than when you learn a language later in life. And as you know, if you learn a language later in life, it's way more difficult. Whereas if you're very young, you're like a sponge, you take all these things in. But what we see as well is that people who are bilingual, you see when or if they develop dementia, they tend to develop dementia differently. It may affect the languages differently. So often you will see a greater impact on the second language than the first one. So you see, for example, people who've migrated to Australia from, say, India, Southeast Asia, and learned English when they were young adults or later in life, when they develop dementia, they start losing English first and then reverting back to their main language, which also creates then other difficulties in terms of the communications with their children who were born here and might not know the language of their parents. You see all these differences in how the dementia can express itself depending on individual differences.
I have a last question, and maybe we can quickly run around the panel with this one. How has studying dementia and aging changed how you view your own life and what you value?
For one, I think it's made me realize that aging is, I think more before I started, aging was something that I guess worried me a lot more. And I think just talking to a lot of different people from different parts of Australia, I think I'm a lot more at peace just with the realities of aging, and also coming to terms with the fact that while there's certain things you can do to control and minimize your risks of certain difficulties and pathologies and diseases later in life, the other challenge is just coming to terms and thinking about how we can sort of live with aging in a way that I guess acknowledges aging's reality. So that's what it's done to me.
Well, I guess for me, I got into this research because of intellectual curiosity. Most people get into dementia research because they have a family member who is affected by it. But I started off just because I thought it was fascinating that we knew so much and so little about these diseases that I wanted to study them.
Oh. And Olivia?
It's a bit like Gilbert. I like who I am now. I don't think I would like to be 20 again. I loved being 20. It was fantastic. I did crazy things. But you know, I'm at a point in my life where there's a history, there's experience, and this comes with aging. You can't jump ahead. And I think that's what is wonderful about aging is that, and as far as I can go back in my studies, I've always been interested in aging and dementia because there's so much to be learned about the life histories, what people have done, what they've gone through, and to understand, their life. And again, coming back to the point I was making earlier, having a diagnosis of dementia is difficult, but it's not necessarily the end of your story. You're still there as a person. There's still things you can experience and live and enjoy and be part of. And I think there's a lot that needs to be done still in that space for the general audience, the general public to understand.
I think that's such an important point and a great one to end on. Can everybody please put their hands together for our wonderful panelists?
The science of keeping your brain healthier for longer, and so much more to be discovered there. Such a live field of research, and I'm hanging on every word, let me tell you. From the University of Sydney's Brain and Mind Centre, Associate Professor Eleanor Drummond and Professor Olivier Piguet. And you also heard from Gilbert Nags, a sociologist at the University of Sydney. And the host of this Sydney Ideas event, with thanks to them, was the journalist Elfie Scott. And be sure to follow Big Ideas on the ABC Listen app. We bring you 4 podcast episodes each week, full of ideas, full of provocations to keep your mind vibed. And I reckon there's an anti-aging solution right there. Think of us as your anti-dementia strategy, folks. Yep, stuff Sudoku. Bye from me, Natasha Mitchell. I'll catch you next time for Big Ideas.
You've been listening to an ABC podcast. Discover more great ABC podcasts, live radio, and exclusives on the ABC Listen app.